Hello, it's me again. Welcome to brand new show. And today we've got another very special guest in the form of the delightful Stuart Morrison. Please say hello, Stuart.
Hello, Stuart.
Now, I'm calling you in your base, the hub, the nerve centre of your expanding empire. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, we're here with the team. So if there's any noise in the background, I do apologise. But I have them under strict instructions not to stop.
Not to stop.
Deadlines. Deadlines.
Greasing the wheels of industry. Well, you might as well give a cheer for your team. Ho, team, say hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, just that's Stuart doing all the funny voices in the background.
Yeah, notice how they all came in at different times.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Stuart. For the lovely listeners in podcast land who haven't a clue who you could possibly be, I know, it is possible. You can say you heard about him here first. Could you give... Oh, I should do give a little proviso. Do you do your own introductions?
I can do. Yes, I do.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so it was just that with my previous guest, Mr. Jez Rose, he didn't normally do his own introductions.
Oh, how nice.
He normally has people.
Has a man in to do, does he?
Yes. I think it's P.
Yeah, I can do it.
Yeah, go ahead. Hello, introduce yourself. Say hello.
Hello, it's Stuart Morrison here, and I run a company. At the moment, it's called Business Web Mentor. We are about to rebrand and rechange. To build for a brighter future. But we are the team that make your website better. It's your website only better is one of our catchphrases. So a lot of times people will be saying, oh, he's the web design guy, which isn't strictly true, because although we do look at and deal with websites and do website updates, it's kind of our methodology to tweak, test, tune and improve people's websites rather than to wipe it out completely and start afresh. You'll see that most of the large companies have eschewed this approach because you see a huge drop off in engagement and then you have to brand build again. So that's kind of what we do. Our team is focused on taking your website and in making an initial improvement to it, and then onward testing, tuning, split testing, and measuring against engagement levels of whatever it is that your website has currently, and getting more people to do more of those things that you want them to do.
So I see that's a comprehensive answer there.
Well,
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a little bit, it's one of those things where you've got to give some context, otherwise it just sounds a bit bland, a bit catchphrasy.
And it's, no, I totally
and it's
get that.
You as well, so I wanted to give you some value.
Well, thank you. That's the director's cut introduction. So you haven't always been the web mentor, have you?
No. Depends how far back you want to go. But, I mean, if we go back to... I think it's important to sort of give some... And I think a lot of the times people come into your life at a certain point and they think, oh, he must have always been like that. Or, oh, that's amazing. How do I get like that? Or, you know, I don't want to set myself on a pedestal like that. But sometimes people look at where you are and go, wow, it's so easy for him, da, 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 da. And I think if you know a little bit of the background, it gives you an understanding of how preparation and life prepares you for where you end up. So I started out as an engineer, and I did a proper engineering, old-fashioned engineering apprenticeship. And when I left engineering, it was always my dream to become an actor. And whilst trying to realise that dream, I ended up working on one of the biggest launches of the internet in the UK for an internet service provider called Netcom UK, who unfortunately were outspent by AOL and CompuServe, and then latterly Pipex. But I used to go around selling the internet. So I'd go into a PC world and I'd stand there and I'd say to people, have you heard about the internet? And they'd say no. And then I'd have to demonstrate on a laptop what the internet was with no internet connection, which was always fun. So we had...
Well, this was the time when the internet was actually carried around in a box, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. In fact, we were at pains to show that AOL was an online service provider, and Netcom UK was an internet service provider. And do you remember when AOL came out, they gave you selected services from the internet in a ring-fenced kind of way. And if you wanted to go beyond that fence, they would charge you per minute of connectivity. And people were getting huge bills for straying onto a website that may not be family-friendly, shall we say.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, it seems like... Because, you know, the internet and the way we all connect, it's ubiquitous. It's, I wouldn't say it's insidious, but it certainly kind of sort of wheedles its way into every area of our life. And it's hard to imagine that there was a time barely 20 years ago,
yeah,
that it was kind of new and unusual.
Well, it was back in 96 that I was doing this, and I was also doing some product design. That was kind of how I sort of got into the inverted commas web design area. And somebody said to me, oh, you're a designer and you're doing this internet thing. Can you build me a website? And I said, yes, because I figured, well, how hard could it actually be to put some... Because I knew about FTP and putting files online. So I figured, how hard could it be? And in the end, I advertised for somebody locally, and that was one of the first iteration of my business and what we did. And then we just sort of started growing websites. But I realized at that point, the first website we ever did was a business directory for Bracknell. And it was a guy who lived in Bracknell who thought he could go around and charge all these businesses for being in his directory. So he was quite an early adopter in that sense. And he made a little bit of money and, you know, we helped him with that. But I realized that very early on, it wasn't about having a website. It was about having a website that got found. But beyond that, most people weren't thinking. They were just like, we need a website. And I was always like, we need a website that gets you found. So we were sort of one step ahead. And now we're not only do you need a website that gets found, but you need a website that gets found and converts those people into business, into your company. So that's the next step that we're offering people.
I see. Because you talked about context being quite important, and we kind of might know you better, perhaps in certain circles, as a looky-likey, and that you told the story of how you actually used the skills that you developed and actually put them into practice, promoting your kind of performance side of business. Is that the case?
The business... The design business, through a stupid error that I made, I managed to annoy my biggest customer. Well, I felt it was a little unfair that they were expecting me to have 90-day terms on £20,000 worth of debt without having priorly asked me about that. So eventually they parted company from our company, and that meant I had to find something else pretty quick that I could do. And one thing led to another, and I ended up, I became Ali G lookalike by accident. I was managing a Madonna lookalike, and she needed some photos, and Ali G had just done this video with her for this pop video for this song she'd written. So I thought it'd be funny for me to dress up as Ali G, not expecting the photographs that we generated and sent to agents, for the agents to say, we'll book both the acts. And it was my performance background that I was also performing at the time and doing stuff that I just thought, well, why not? And then I started beating all the lookalike agencies to the top of the search engines with the skills that I'd developed, and didn't really look back from that. And then it went into Borat and the Little Britain characters. And we were hugely, hugely popular and successful. And at one time... it would be, the phone just would not stop ringing. I'd pick up the phone and it would be another booking, and pick up the phone. And every single time is, I found you on the internet. I found you on the internet. I found you on the internet. And I once got phoned by a large directory agency who were trying to persuade me that they could market my website better than I could. So I had this phone call from a gentleman called Stephen. And he said to me, your website might not be appearing on the first page of Google. And I said to him, go and type in Ali G lookalike. So he did. And I said, what can you see? He said, well, you know, and I said, yes, that's me at the top. I'm in second place. I'm also in third place. My other website is in fourth place. And the two directories that then come in fifth and sixth, I'm also on. And that final bottom one is my own personal blog. So I actually, it was a pretty much me. If anyone was going to look for an Ali G lookalike, I was all over the front page. He said, so you don't need me? No, thank you. And then I get a phone call 5 minutes later and he said, hi, your website might not be appearing at the top of the search engine. I said, is this Stephen? He said, yes. I said, we've just spoken. He said, but I'm phoning you about a Borat lookalike. He said, yes, yes, you'll find that I'm sort of dominant in Ali G and Borat. So anyway, about 10 minutes later, I get another phone call. Hi, you might not realise, but your website needs to come up at the top of the search engines. And I said, is that Stephen? He went, yes. I said, are you phoning about the Little Britain lookalikes? And the phone just was hung up. the point being that, you know, if you're going to do it for your business, then have different niche websites for the different clients. And we could have quite easily had a website that had all three acts on. But when somebody turned or was looking for a specific act, not only does Google want to find a website that answers the niche specifically, so therefore Ali G lookalike. If I'd have put Ali G lookalike, Borat lookalike and Little Britain lookalike on the same website, that is essentially one third of the website devoted to each act. Whereas if I have three separate websites, that is 100% of that website devoted to that content, and therefore it is more relevant in the Google algorithm, and that is still relevant today.
So it's kind of evidence or anecdotal evidence of the value of niching, which is now very much a buzzword of the moment.
Oh,
when it comes to branding.
Absolutely. And I think that most businesses look and go, well, we can do this, we can do this, we can do this, we can do this, and they write down everything they can do. When in actual fact, if they were to look at a profitability scale and see where their main profit or the main activities that they profit from came and just niche their sites down to that, well, two things would happen. One, they'd only find clients where they know that they're more profitable servicing. And two, Google would only rank them for that much more relevant content because they would be seen to be niched in that way. And I think that it goes back to a lot of what businesses are bad at, and that's knowing their numbers, whether that number is in and around visitors and how they're behaving on their website or down to cost of acquisition per customer.
So with that in mind, you've developed a quite a clear direction, if you like, for the Business Web Mentors offering, which is very much, as I understand, it's about kind of guiding people through the minefield of, yes, you have to have a website, that's a given now, but the old ideas are wrong, embrace the new ones. Or is it just kind of reiterating the old ways of doing things?
It's a little from column A, a little from column B, to be fair. Because it's new technology, people have thrown away the baby with the bathwater. They've ignored the fact that actually it's only a marketing channel, like leaflets are a marketing channel, like classified ads are a marketing channel. And everybody thinks that they need to be doing, having a website and doing all this stuff online, when in actual fact they haven't got a structured approach, and they see that the social media, let's do that. Oh, Twitter, I'll be on that. I need to do now Pinterest. Oh, and Google Plus. And what they need to actually do is to have a structure that starts with their website, extends into their blog, and then uses the external websites around, like your social media sites, to publicise what their activities are, but to also use other activities, offline activities, to drive traffic at their website or their business. Because ultimately, everyone just wants the phone to ring. You know, The ultimate thing would be people phoning you with orders. But we know that doesn't happen, or it doesn't happen so readily. So what we've got to do is to nurture and warm up people who are possibly interested or raising their hand and saying, I may be in your market. And that's kind of what we're trying to do. And that's what advertising has been doing for millennia. You know, you basically get somebody to get interested in your business, raise their hand to the point where you can interact with them, and that's the no part. Then when you're interacting with them, do they like you? And ultimately, do they trust you? And nobody's ever bought until they've trusted, because how can you buy something you don't think will solve the problem if you don't trust the business? So we're in the business of making people's websites get people to the point where they trust them enough to want to take the next step. And that next step may be downloading something that you're offering them to as a freebie or as an introduction or at a very low cost. And that then takes them to the next step where you prove your worth to them and give them massive value. Because once you've done that, then there'll be a solid customer who will want to buy. And that is very much what I've been doing for the last, well, in Business Web Mentor, it's what I've been doing since the beginning of the year. But we have been doing this in one form or another within the businesses that I've run, whether it's a lookalike business, a print business or whatever, getting a solid reputation for delivering quality in the field that you're in.
So that idea of delivering quality and people liking you and trusting you is so vital, and you've built quite a compelling kind of personal brand based around what you know and what your experience is and your ability to present it in an engaging way. You've developed quite a distinctive look. This is obviously an oral medium, so we can't show pictures. Yeah. But the picture of you will be on the podcast bumper. But tell me the story about how that look came about and how that sits with generating trust in your customers, because that's so vital, isn't it?
Okay, so there's two elements to this, and these are all borne out by real world experience from having been a performer. When you're a lookalike, a lot of the jobs that you get are about entertaining a room, not actually on a stage, not on a focused audience, but entertaining in a room. So it's called mix and mingle or meet and greet. And you just basically, you wander around the room entertaining people as you go. And when you walk into the room, you've got to make an impression. And with Ali G, it was very easy. I would literally stop the party by making a very loud, a high energy entrance and get people whooping and cheering and lift the mood in the room. And then suddenly people are a bit excited about you being there. And the reason that you could do that is because these people will all be standing around in formal wear or in smart casual or in business attire. And then suddenly this guy in a big yellow suit turns up and starts insulting people and making them laugh and generally interacting with them. And you're introducing a different energy into the room, and that's what people are responding to. And I think that if you are going to make an impression on people, you have to change their energy state. And I know that's getting a little esoteric, but if you don't make an impression with your look and your attitude, then what else is there left? And that's your personal brand, like a logo and a design style isn't your brand. Your brand is what happens in the mind of the people who are interacting with you as a business. And that comes from doing business in a certain style. You know, you think about Nike, it's the tick and the just do it, but they're so much more than that. They're about sport and about winning and about personal achievement, because it's not all about world record breaking. It's about that achieving something of just getting out of your chair and just doing it. And that's what they've become very good at communicating, because they have a certain energy about them. And I think that most small businesses are a bit shy about having that approach. So I went, the second part to this was, I went to a comedy conference in Palm Springs. And there were two things that happened that made me realise that personal branding can be used by anyone at any point in any field. So obviously, if I'm dressed in a large yellow suit and I wander into a room and start shouting my mouth off in an Ali G type way, I'm going to make an impact. People are going to remember that. But there are ways of doing that in business that you don't have to be in a large yellow suit, but you can still make that impression. And one of the things that I realised was, I was given a book by a lady called Sam Horn, and it was called Pop, Stand Out in Any Crowd. Now, Sam and I got chatting because one of the things that she said was always wear a hat. And I've always worn hats. I loved hats. I think they're great. And they're a real icebreaker as well, because at this comedy conference, it was only me and her who was wearing hats. And I was known as the Brit in the hat, because obviously being in Palm Springs, there was a lot of Americans and not many. Well, I was the only English person. But wearing the hat meant that I was doubly more impactful, because not only was I the Brit, I was visually impactful because I was the tall guy in the hat. And it wasn't a bowler, actually. It was just a pork pie hat. So we went out for an evening meal and everyone sat down this table. And there was about 40 people down a very long table and it was all very stilted. And I'd noticed on the walk to the restaurant that there was a fancy dress place. So I dashed out of this thing, went into this fancy dress place, and I bought a load of hats. I bought a Viking hat, I bought tricorn, I bought a variety of hats, fairly cheap, $2 or $3 each, just grabbed these hats and went back and just started passing them around the table and plonked them on a few people's heads. And the conversation instantly changed, because you can't be a serious, boring person when you've got a Viking helmet on your head. And suddenly these people started being these characters, and there was a little bit of energy, and we changed the energy with the hats. So I was always interested in, how a hat can have that impression. So I grew the tash, and it just seemed to me very, very congruent to have a bowler, that traditional eccentric Brit look. And it kind of suits me. And somebody said to me the other day, it was like the perfect compliment. They said, "You're like the Sherlock Holmes of web marketing." And I kind of see what they mean. It's a bit of a traditional Sherlock, mindset, but with modern technology. And she was specifically referring to the current Sherlock on the TV. It's been a layering effect, and I think that you can't just go out and assume a personal brand that doesn't actually fit, because people will tell that the energy is wrong, that you're playing a part rather than it being you. And I've always worn really nice shoes, or that I think other people might think, my God, they're a bit outrageous. I've always worn loud shirts, whether they've been Hawaiian or loud T-shirts. And I've always had fairly distinctive hair. I used to have a 1 foot red Mohican with the side shaved back in my late teens. And the point is, it's about being remembered. After you leave the room, people still talk about you. And I think it was either Oscar Wilde or Lady Astor that somebody said, she said, "What's the worst thing than being talked about?" And the interviewer said, "I don't know." She said, "Not being talked about." And I think that's the point, isn't it? I don't care whether or not somebody might think, he's a bit over the top, it's a bit loud, it's a bit noisy, and the fact that they've remembered me ticks the box for me, because ultimately they'll get beyond that and realise that there's an actual very serious approach we take to what we do. But we've broken through. The personal branding is the same whether they see me walking down the street or at a business event. I don't change the way I dress. They might see me in one of my outrageous suits just as much doing the shopping with the family as they would at one of the events that we go to. And that's the key to it with personal branding. It isn't something you put on just to go out and do some business. That it may be slightly tweaked or tuned up a little bit at an event where there are 1,000 people and you've got to be remembered, but it's essentially the same you.
I see, because you've covered some really interesting ideas there, and I was just thinking about a comedy conference and this idea of all these people trying to be funny. And I can, because comedians, because you've done stand-up comedy, haven't you?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
And there's this suggestion that actually comedians are actually quite maudlin and morose, and that actually they just, they're invariably alcoholics or certainly with some kind of mental disorder. I mean, I'm just a sweeping generalisations, obviously, but it's that kind of thing that they perform, they switch themselves on and they become funny. And they have the people laughing, and then there's a point where they're not performing, and then the laughter dies, and they're miserable again. And so that kind of flagged up for me this idea about how if you're going to live it, there is this. It's absolutely vital to be congruent, to actually have some substance behind what you're presenting. Because the other side of it, if you're going to be kind of, it does help that you're tall, which you are.
Yeah.
But this idea of walking into a room and going, "Hey, here I am," and everybody goes, "Who's that idiot?" How do you kind of, I guess, from what you've demonstrated in terms of kind of like your kind of technical skill and knowledge, how do you get people on side straight away to actually say that he's more than just a tall guy with a tash and a bowler hat?
It's quite interesting that in "Who's That Idiot," there are three words, and two of them are "Who's that?" and the third one is "Idiot." So two-thirds of that sentence is about "Who's that?" And that's what I'm trying to do. I don't care if a third of the people think I'm an idiot. They're not for me. They're not going to... Me and them are never going to probably be seeing eye to eye. It's the two-thirds of the people who go, "Who's that?" and then stop at the "Who's that?" that I'm interested in. How do you get people to take you seriously? By engaging with them. But you can go through this life in two ways. And, in fact, Al Capone said, you can walk through this life with a smile and big stick, and 99 times out of 100, all you need is a smile. Well, as far as I'm concerned, all you need is a smile. And if I can make somebody smile and get through to them a serious business message whilst they're smiling, they're learning. Because, actually, you touched on a really valid point there, you know, because comedy's about a truth. It's about a truth that you've laid so bare that people go, "Oh, my God, I didn't think of that," and laugh because it touches on them. You know, Michael McIntyre talks about the man draw, you know, and you laugh about it because everybody has got a man draw, you know, or most men.
A person draw,
yeah. But the point is, they're touching on a truth. They're touching on something that you recognise to be a universal experience. You can't make comedy to a room full of people who you don't share an experience with, because they just will go, they won't get it. They'll just say, "I'm sorry, I don't have that point of reference." So, actually coming from a point of comedy, and what you're saying about comedians, sometimes a lot of the time, and I've heard it said that the difference between a mentally ill person and a comedian is a mentally ill person with an audience. And that's a flip way of saying, you know, they're putting themselves out there, they're bearing their soul, they're being truthful, and you might not laugh. But you might not laugh, and then they've revealed a huge secret, inner secret about themselves that might be very embarrassing. But that's the danger line. Isn't that the fun? And I always said, it's not that you've crossed the line, it's how quickly you cross it. Because if you're really outrageous and you've done it and you're back being less than outrageous very quickly, it was how I used to make people laugh as Ali G. You know, I could wander up to somebody and be very personally insulting, but they knew that it was fun. And I think that once people realise it's fun and I'm playing with this perception and with the bowler hat and the tash, and it's, you know, I could dress boring and conservatively, but I don't think it would suit my personality. And so people would possibly think, well, he's a bit outrageous, and then I'm dressed in a standard three-piece suit and it's not congruent. At least they're being prepared for what they're going to get when they have a conversation with me. So,
well, you nailed it on the head there, really, because I think that there's this idea of it is possible to be less than serious in the approach but deadly serious about the subject.
Mm.
And this is something that in my time as an entrepreneur to try and kind of get one's head around the fact that, yes, you can, in your instance, wear a big moustache and a bowler hat and end a chain as you go along. But the fact is that you know the subject matter. And I think that there's this notion, this perception about being serious and conforming to the right way of doing things it's so vital that you actually stand for something. Isn't it? Stand for something and actually live it.
Well, I think that's the second part of it. You can't personally brand if there's not a solid business case behind it. If you're unable to back it up, if you're unable to actually follow through and deliver on what, you know, the promise of the shop window is, then you'll get found out really rather quickly. But I think personal branding is a slower burn to a certain extent than what a lot of people do, which is just try and plug away and get themselves known by doing loads of advertising. I think you can have some quick wins with that, but as fast as you've got the customers, I think you lose the customers. Whereas with personal branding, people get to know you and your business style and stick around longer because they enjoy the ride as much as they do the destination.
Mm-hmm. I think that this idea of the kind of a journey is very apt as well, because we have as consumers immense choice about who we choose to do business with, who we choose to buy into as it stands, which business people or which voices we choose to trust. Yeah. And this element of trust and actually engagement and the way that we connect with people. And as you quite rightly said, this idea about comedy being a kind of a shortcut almost to trust, you know, people will say that, you know, one of the ideal characteristics of an ideal lover is a good sense of humour.
Mm. But also, and the flip side of that is, and I firmly believe this, and it's borne out time and time again, is you can't be a good comedian unless you're really intelligent. You've got to be really smart. Not only has your brain got to think whip smart when you're stood in front of an audience that's live and you're running through your material, if you get heckled, you've got to be able to handle that. So there's a number of things going on there. But also, coming up with comedy is about making associations between things which are, on the face of it, unassociated. And you need to have a brain which can put those incongruent items together and draw some congruence out of it and a common truth. And mm-hmm. you can't do that unless you're smart. And you think about all the great comedians. One of the defining characteristics of them is they were really smart. You know, they may have had personal lives that were disastrous or may have had personal interactions. Like, you look at Peter Sellers. He was horrible to his family, to a lot of the people around him, if you crossed him. And he would hold grudges. I mean, there was... I don't think it's... I don't think it's a secret, but once his son scratched his Pride and Joy's car, so he got his son's toy car and stomped on it. And I just think that, you know, that level of torment, there must have been something underneath that. But you can't deny the fact that he was whip smart and had some of the, you know, best characters of his time with the Clouseau and the Goons and that. I think one comes with the other. Certain mm-hmm. personality, a certain type, which is perhaps why I am not now a stand-up comedian, is maybe I wasn't tortured enough as a child.
But I think the whole thing about putting yourself up as an entrepreneur, putting yourself up in front of an audience, be they comedians, be they a comic audience, but I'm thinking more in a case of educating business owners and actually standing, putting yourself up in the firing line to be in a position of, I'm telling you this. And there's always going to be somebody in the audience who wants to disrupt or unsettle or prove that they're more intelligent than you. And I always admire, and this I really think this is a sign of somebody who really does know their stuff. And yes, it's vital to be quick-witted. And one of the most kind of depressing situations is having to explain yourself to people who don't quite understand. But being in front of an audience and actually having the ability to think on your feet, make connections and respond to requests based on your extensive knowledge. Absolutely, the goodwill out in that context.
If you are standing and doing one-to-many presentation, I think if you've got that skill, whether you enjoy doing it or not is another matter, but if you've got that skill and the more you enjoy it, the more people will warm to you and believe you and the more comfortable you get. And I think it's no secret that Steve Jobs hated it to start with, but as he grew more confident about his product, he became more confident. And he used to go over and over and polish and hone and tune his presentations until they were absolutely just bang on. And the reason he did that was that he felt more comfortable when his presentation was like that. My presentation style is very different to that. I have a very good understanding of my subject matter. I have a know that I need to get from A to B and a timescale to do it in. And then I'll just riff. and know I've got to hit certain stepping stones on the way, but I'm much more comfortable in front of a live audience when I'm unscripted. Whereas my wife, who's an actress, that is her nightmare. She would have stress dreams about being on stage and not knowing what to say. Whereas, of course, being a lookalike and that, it fitted really well that I knew the character, and but I knew it so well that I could put him in any situation and say anything, and I knew that people would go, that's congruent to what that how that character would behave. So it's not that I'm being outrageous. I'm being outrageous in a Ali G way, and that's what gets the laughs.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that I conform to that kind of free-flowing riffing state, because I find it very difficult to kind of force myself into scripts. I delivered 2-3-hour lectures on Monday, and I had a good idea of what I needed to cover, but without actually scripting it to the nth degree. And sort of walking in there with a gun, I'm like, I'm not entirely sure how this is going to go, but 6 hours later, I delivered it, and the college were very happy with the outcome. And I guess I think we need to, every now and again, reassure ourselves as business owners and brand builders that we do know our stuff. And
there's nothing more attractive than that confidence. You talked about personal attraction and that people having a good sense of humour was one of it. But it's not just having a good sense of humour. It's about being confident with it. It's not about offering a joke up with a question mark at the end of it. It's that you make a statement and you stand by it.
And there was something else that came out of that I thought was really quite poignant. And that was the idea of that it's actually... It's bigger than you, really. I think that the idea that... I don't know what it was. I'd like to try and present it in a very kind of flowing stream of consciousness style, but I do have some notes here that I'm referring to. It's audio. It's fine. But this idea that the business web mentor, the business itself, you're expanding and growing. We're not actually playing a track on the bottom of this call. It's actually happening in a live office where people are beavering away.
Absolutely.
But it's getting to the stage now where you are no longer just the business web mentor or Stu the computery or website guy or even the looky-likey. You are now developing a brand which has to stand for something that obviously you embody, but you aren't necessarily delivering. How are you finding that transition and that growth?
Yeah, I think it's really easy. When you find...
Oh, right.
No, but there's a caveat on the end of that. You didn't let me get to it.
But
I think it's really easy when you find people who are aligned with your goals. I think that if you have to instill in people goals that they don't either have or aren't prepared to accept, then you're going to have a fight on your hands. If you can find people who go, yeah, I believe in what you're doing, and actually I have been saying this in a similar way prior to this or in my previous job or with other clients, and you get them on board and you're able to strengthen not only what you do, but they get positive feedback on what they do, and it creates a rallying call around which you all can benefit. And that, you know, it's all very well and good me going out and saying I believe in this and this is the way it should be. If my team are saying really, or saying to people, well, we don't really believe in it, but we go for it because he pays us the money.
He beats us.
He keeps us in a cupboard and feeds us scraps, and we're grateful for that.
I now have this vision, right, as soon as the camera goes off, that they're all going, don't put us back in the cupboard again.
As my dad said, that he never mistreated us because there was always coal in the fire. And at Christmas, sometimes he'd let us light it. So, yeah, you can see why I'm no longer a comedian. But the point to it is that when Steve Jobs created Apple, he wanted to put a ding in the universe. And if people came on board and didn't align themselves with that value, then they didn't stick around for long for two reasons. One, they would find it an awkward place to work in because they're pointing in a different direction. in like a school of fish. If you're travelling at 90 degrees to where the school's travelling, you're going to find it a bumpy ride. But the other point to it is, if you're not aligned with it, you become a dead weight. You become a drag weight. You slow the, you know, in a metaphor sense, you slow the boat down. And, you know, if you're not making the boat go faster, which is a reference that a lot of people listening to this might recognise, then why would somebody want to remain in that organisation? Because you're just going to feel uncomfortable. If everyone's cheering and you're going, oh, I can't find the energy to cheer at this because I don't actually believe in it, you're going to be, you can't keep that level of pretense up, and you'll get found out. And one of the two things will happen: either your work won't align with the standard and the level and the direction that the rest of the team's going in, so you'll get found out, or customers will start leaving because they don't believe in what it is you're saying. And I think that the personal branding side of it, it's all very well and good standing up and saying, this is me, this is who I am, this is what I look like. But unless there is a solid core behind it, that when people look, pick it up, examine it, see the results, hear what you say, you know, and we're going to be going out very soon and making some very controversial statements about web design and the approach to web design that most people take. But we've got the numbers, we've got the experience, we've got the stats and the details to back it all up. And that's when it becomes very, very interesting, that you become very high vis, pointing at other people saying, I think they're getting it wrong, and these are the reasons, and this is our experience, and what we're doing is actually having a better result. That's when you become, in the terms of somebody that we know well, that's when you become super successful, because your goals, your experience, your personal branding and your team all align. It's all aligned along a like an arrow pointing in a direction and moving in that direction with some purpose, that people can't but help be compelled to at least acknowledge you're about. And I think with small businesses, that 95% of small businesses don't tell anyone they exist. They try and promote themselves and try and do a bit of marketing, but actually they've got to tell people that they exist. And the Simon Sinek thing, start with why, is vitally important. If you're doing something and you're doing it for the money, then you haven't got any passion for it. But I genuinely believe that 99% of web designers are getting it wrong and don't have the necessary skills to create a win for business people. And that's going to tread on a few toes. And I know it is, but what can I do? If I know that to be true, or I have a very, very clear indication from what we're doing that I can prove that statement, then why would I hide that light under a bushel? It might be offending some people, but that's fine. They're the ones who are getting it wrong. I'm offended that they're out there giving their clients bad advice.
So we can anticipate an imminent revolution.
A very polite, very British, excuse me, a cough. And excuse me, sir. Yeah, there we go. There's a cough.
On demand.
Presentation of an invoice, and we can help people.
Okay.
But no, but seriously, if I see wrong being done and I know that a better way to do something, I think I have a moral obligation, not just a business obligation, but a moral obligation to stand up and say, this is wrong. This is being done wrong.
Well, I mean, it comes up time and time again when people say, oh, you know, I went to such and such to get this done. And you just have to, on one hand, you don't want to sort of say, if you can't say anything good, don't say anything. But I certainly find as I get older, I feel that I become less tolerant or and more curmudgeonly, perhaps.
Yeah,
and then you actually want to kind of like say, well, actually, yeah, no, that is wrong. And this is what my experience has shown me. And why are they telling you differently?
But I understand what you're saying, and exactly the same. You know, we're shown stuff. But there are a number of reasons why that solution has been put in place. It may be client briefed incorrectly, the budget wasn't there, the goals weren't aligned, there wasn't enough research done, the experience that was being delivered by the provider wasn't good enough. You know, there's a whole panoply of problems that could have occurred between the idea and being it being delivered. So I don't like to point the finger and say these people have got it wrong. But when you see the same mistakes being made by a particular team over and over and over again, you have to say, well, why are they making these mistakes? It's one of two things. It's either they don't know that they're making those mistakes, or they do know and can't be bothered to do anything about it. I then have to make a value judgment on that of like, well, if you do know you're making those mistakes and just can't be bothered, then that would say to me that that's professional negligence. You just can't be asked to sort of do it the right way. Or if it's the other way, that you don't know it's wrong, then why have to question why you're even in business? Because if you're not keeping up with what's going on, especially in an ever-changing field such as web development and web marketing, then why are you telling people, oh, here you go, look at this, and they have a look at it and they go, I don't like it. Oh, it's only a first draft. Well, not quite how you should be. Bits you stand for a bit more than, oh, we'll do whatever it is you say. Well, actually, you're the professionals, you tell me what I should have. You went to the doctor and the doctor said, here's the diagnosis, if you don't like it, I'll change my mind. you'd very quickly find another doctor. I'm finding it harder and harder and harder to bite my tongue, like you said, when it comes to certain things. I'm quite forgiving when certain people say, you know, this is my website, and for whatever reason, it's the way it is. That's, you know, a lot of the times it's down to budget, and I accept that. I understand that. You've done the best you can at the time with the money available to you. But there are things that you can do. The thinking behind an activity shouldn't depend upon the budget. You shouldn't give poorer thinking to your clients who are on a more restricted budget than to those who can afford more. They should get a consistent delivery across your entire range of what it is you can do. They're just buying in at a different rate of delivery, either a slower rate of delivery or a smaller amount of your time, or, you know, maybe a more DIY approach where you give them the advice and they do it themselves. You shouldn't alter the quality of what you do. And I find that I've interacted with a few people who said that, you know, they've seen sites that other teams have done, and they know that because the person spent more money, that they felt like they got a better job than the one that they've been given because they're on a budget. I find that a very difficult thing to square away.
Yeah, because I mean that kind of points to this idea about the process and the methodology being standard, but the outcomes at the end being unique. And so, what I'm going to say, I mean, it sounds like you're talking with passion. You are obviously talking with passion. It's quite clear that you have a passion for what you do. If there was somebody, because obviously it's great with hindsight to say, well, you know, I went this way and I did this route and I've gone through these stages and this is where I am now. And it was all planned and it's all gone according to my master plan. Has it? Or have you found yourself in a situation where now, because you're looking for it, things have aligned and actually now this is the right time for you?
It's the right time for me. There's a lot of times when you look back, like you say, when you look over your shoulder, you see a straight path. But when you look forward, you just see this branching network of decisions that you could make on an almost daily and infinite basis. I've got a talk that I do. In fact, there's two talks I do. I do one on web development, web design, web marketing for anybody to come along to who wants to learn about that and how to do it in their business. But I do a more general one about, it's called Success is Not a Straight Line. And it's about how every time I've failed, that a crossroads has been reached and you make a decision, and how by failing, I've made increasingly better decisions at those failure points, because you're learning all the time, you're refining. And I give this example in the talk that you've got to train yourself in business to spot opportunities, and not just opportunities, but the value of those opportunities and how they present themselves to you. And the example I give is if you've had the fortune of having a child, when your wife announces she's pregnant, suddenly the world is full of pregnant people. And you wander around and there's strollers and babies, and suddenly it becomes very, very obvious that, you know, babies and that are around. If you break your arm and you've got your arm in a car, suddenly the world is full of people with broken arms. Or you decide to buy a car, a blue car, suddenly the world is full of blue polos. And you suddenly go, where have these all come from? But the point to it is that your brain is a pattern recognition machine, and you have suddenly started to recognise the pattern, and an opportunity is just a pattern. And if you can recognise the opportunity and train yourself to, or to see and be aware of the pattern that happens around an opportunity that you can make business sense of, then you get better at that. So your failures actually just add to the list of things that you know that doesn't make a good opportunity, because you go, well, I can do that, but I know that that leads to this, this, this and this, which leads to that problem. So as long as my opportunity doesn't include these particular aspects, I can monetize that opportunity. And that's, as you get older, you just become better and more reinforced, if you're clever, about what makes a good opportunity for you. Mm. And layering up branding on top of that is fine, you know, that's part of it. But if you can layer the branding, and again, it's this alignment. You align the branding with the passion, with the understanding, with the knowledge, and with the experience, and you put all of those things together in a package, and it's almost like an irresistible force.
Absolutely. And it's just proving that it has to stand for something. And the fact is that the journey might not necessarily have been in a straight line, but right now, at this moment in time, it stands for something. And I'm very excited, very excited to hear the next iteration of Brand Web Mentors, Brand Business Web Mentors, the next iteration of the brand.
I think the next iteration that will be happening before the end of July was very, very clearly a team decision. And the name, the look, the style, the feel of it is very, very congruent with what we've done, and is actually a more refined version of Business Web Mentor, both in terms of name and in terms of look. And it's almost like stripping away all of the non-essential bits and just leaving the core of what we do, both iteratively with our clients and externally brand-wise. And I think that that's what happens when you look at any brand. I mean, one of the brands that always makes me smile is when you look at Nokia. Nokia is a very well-known brand. They've spent a lot of money on their brand. When you look at their first iteration of their design, I think it's a trout leaping out of a stream with some trees in the background in a very graphic style. And they were a tire company. And they started out as a tire company, and they're now known for mobile phones. And how they went on that journey is a very interesting, if you investigate that and you read up about it, even just the facts are interesting. But I think that what happens is, one, they spotted an opportunity. Two, they were in the position to do it. Three, they realised that their brand had to change to align with this new, more modern technology. And four, they did it with passion because they believed in it and built a team around it that could deliver on it. And I think all of those things, that sometimes if your branding isn't aligned with your passion and your beliefs and your deliverables, that can hold it back, which is why having had some thinking in and around our next iteration, and making sure it's on target, you just suddenly, I call it singing. When it sings to you, when it feels like there's something inside you vibrating at the same rate that this thing, you know, like hearing a good song, and you're like, it impacts on you at a level that is almost subconscious. You can't say, why are you like a song? I like the beat, or I like the tune, or I like the melody, the lyrics. It just gets you. It just inside you vibrates you, and you just feel. And that's the same with a good brand, and that's the same with a good business. And that's, I think that's what trust is, that vibration in the other person, that these people, I trust them to do what it's that I want them to do. it gets all a bit touchy-feely at that point.
And, before we kind of, like, reach out and have a group hug, I'd like to say, before we kind of, like, we can now switch off the microphones and now start touching ourselves, but tell the lovely listeners, if they would like to find more about what it is that you stand for and what you're about, how can they find you on the interwebs?
Well, they can go to www.businesswebmentor.com. And they will either be redirected to our new website, which is coming up very soon, which is still under wraps at the moment, or they can find out about us at businesswebmentor.com.
Fantastic.
Simple as that, really.
Simple as that. Excellent. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, Stuart. Thank you very much for joining me. I wish you every success with the launch and the new facelift. And goodbye to your team.
Bye.
Get back to work. Go on.
Get back to work. Have a great life. Speak to you again soon. All the best for now.
Cheers. Thank you, Neil.